Let's talk sports. This is Kent Batty, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'll be reading to you today from the USA Today Sports Weekly for October 15th through the 21st. And today is the 15th, and since the National League and American League Baseball Championships are in full swing, I thought we'd start with some baseball stories. To give you the current status as of the 15th, the Dodgers are ahead of the Brewers 2-0 in their 7-game series. And in the American League, it's the Seattle Mariners up 2-0 over the Toronto Blue Jays. So, for our first story, I'll read a column by Bob Nightingale, who writes for USA Today. The Los Angeles Dodgers popped some champagne on October 9th, chugged Bud Lights, and hugged one another while half-dressed. But as far as celebrations go, well, there may have been more jubilation at a senior citizen bingo parlor than the Dodgers National League Division Series clinching party. The Dodgers felt more relief on this night, surviving a heavyweight bout against the Philadelphia Phillies with an epic 2-1 11-inning victory, winning the National League Division Series 3-1. Really, the Dodgers will tell you, after a brief party in their indoor batting cage, so not to mess up their fancy new clubhouse, they were simply too exhausted to properly celebrate. They can do that in the next round, knowing that another series victory will provide a return trip to the World Series. And if they win the World Series again, becoming the first NL team to pull it off since the Cincinnati Reds' Big Red Machine in 75-76, then you'll see a real bash that will make Hollywood envious. But for now, they just wanted to chill, soaking in the moment, believing that by surviving this grueling series, they can beat anyone coming their way. It was a war, Dodgers manager Dave Roberts said. It was a battle. It was an instant classic. It may take years for the Dodgers to fully appreciate what they just accomplished, but on this night, their heads were still spinning. I don't know where that ranks being part of a game like that, but it definitely ranks up there, says Dodgers third baseman Max Muncy. Extra innings at home against a really, really good team, great pitching, both teams playing like there's no tomorrow. And for it to end on a throwing error with their pitcher throwing back to home plate, man, that's just crazy. It was only an elimination game for the Phillies, but the Dodgers will tell you it felt like a game 7 to them. The two teams spent 3.5 hours trading punches and left it all out on the field. Parenthetically, now that our writer has completed reference to two overused cliches in baseball, I'll return to the story. Starters Tyler Glasnow and Christopher Sanchez picked 6 scoreless innings apiece, giving up just 3 hits. The Dodgers turned to rookie Roki Sasaki, who pitched 3 perfect innings in one of the greatest relief performances in Dodgers postseason history. The Phillies went to starter Jesus Luzardo, who hadn't pitched in relief in 4 years, to get 5 outs. The biggest stars were shut down with the Dodgers quartet of Shohei Ohtani, Mookie Betts, Freddie Freeman, and Teoscar Hernandez going only 3-for-18 with 7 strikeouts, while Trey Turner, Kyle Schwarber, and Bryce Harper for the Phillies went 1-for-14 with 4 strikeouts. And it ended on a gaffe that had the Dodgers sharing their sympathy for Phillies reliever Orion Kerkering. It's brutal, Roberts said. He'd done it 1,000 times, and right there he was so focused, I'm sure, on just getting the hitter, he just sort of forgot the outs and the situation. The bases were loaded with 2 outs. Ande Páez, the Dodgers' number 9 hitter who was 1-for-24 in the series, was jammed and broke his bat on a 96.2-mile-per-hour fastball. It bounced back to Kerkering, who fumbled the ball and then picked it up with his bare hand. I was just so mad at myself, Páez said, who was still 55 feet away from first base when Kerkering picked up the ball. I saw him grab it and then watched him throw it, but I couldn't believe he didn't throw it to first base. Neither could anyone else at Dodger Stadium. While Phillies catcher J.T. Realmuto pointed toward first base, Páez, barely more than halfway down the line, panic set in. Kerkering fired at home. Even if the throw was perfect, it was going to be too late to get pinch runner Haesung Kim at the plate. "I ran for my life," Kim said. While the ball rolled to the backstop, the Dodgers rushed onto the field, still trying to comprehend exactly what happened. "Once the pressure got to me," Kerkering said, "I just thought, there's a faster throw to JT, a little quicker throw than trying to cross-body it to first base. So, just a horse blank throw." It's baseball. Stuff happens. The Dodgers were in disbelief. But even in the middle of their clubhouse celebration, they talked in subdued tones about the blunder, thrilled that they'd won the game but wanting to express their empathy for Kerkering. "You feel bad," Dodgers infielder Miguel Rojas says, "but at the end of the day, you know you can be that guy because you play in a sport. It's part of baseball, and it happens." For the Dodgers, they were thinking about getting that second ring while awaiting the winner of the Cubs-Milwaukee Brewers series. They're a heavy favorite against Milwaukee. If the Dodgers weren't formidable enough before this series, they've become a beast, with Glasnow not only proving he can pitch under postseason pressure, but debuting a lights-out closer who solved their ninth-inning woes. Sasaki was sensational. 9 up, 9 down. 36 pitches, 26 strikes. Oh my gosh, you're talking about one of the great all-time appearances out of the pen that I can remember, Roberts said. I can't speak enough to his growth and his contribution to this club. We're starting to see something really special in him. It's hard to believe this was the same guy who looked lost all summer. Sasaki, who was the most sought-after free agent on the market since the cost would be only what a team had left in his international signing pool. In the Dodgers' case, it was just $6.5 million. Just $6.5 million. Sasaki opened the season by making 8 starts, yielding a 4.72 ERA, and only twice did he last more than 5 innings. The 100-mile-an-hour fastball that was showcased in Japan was gone, with his velocity dropping about 5 miles per hour. He went on the injured list with shoulder fatigue, struggled in the minors, and then let the Dodgers overhaul his pitching mechanics. Sasaki's dominance has everyone in the organization feeling confident that they once again are the team to beat, knowing already that their rotation is the best in baseball with Otani, Blake Snell, and Yoshinobu Yamamoto. The Dodgers, after going 5-1 this postseason, have begun the countdown. 8 more victories, and they are World Series champions again for the 3rd time in just 6 years. "It feels great, but we know we have a lot of baseball to be played," the Dodgers' Enrique Hernandez said. "Our goal is to win the World Series. The goal is not to win the NLDS." And now for a story from Lori Nickel of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The Woodpeckers beat the prodigal son who left for the big city lights, and we are going to need months, maybe years, to fully understand and thoroughly appreciate the paradigm shift that happened in Wisconsin sports history on a dreamlike Saturday night, October 11th at American Family Field. 3 home runs by the no-swing, big swag, small market, underdog Brewers from William Contreras, Andrew Vaughn, and Bryce Turang, plus a wizardly 4-inning spell by 23-year-old rookie Jacob Mizrowski, led the Heroics as Milwaukee beat the Chicago Cubs 3-1 in an epic Game 5 of their National League Division Series. Most of them weren't even here and aren't even old enough to comprehend the drama that unfolded less than 2 years ago. But the rest of us, goodness gracious, can say we've survived it. Craig Counsell, who grew up in Whitefish Bay, Wisconsin, whose dad worked for the Brewers, who himself played in 2 stints for the Brewers, and then managed the team for 9 mostly winning years, could not beat Milwaukee to get where he ultimately wanted to go, wearing that Cubs primary blue. Counsell also would not best his own mentor and friend, the always teaching, always believing Pat Murphy. "I'm disappointed, sad," said Counsell, just minutes after the final out. Counsell has faced the Brewers numerous times before, but never with everything on the line like in Game 5. Counsell instantly became enemy number 1 when he departed home and became the highest paid manager in baseball when he landed on Addison Street. It's ancient history to everyone else now, but Here, it might never be forgotten that Council wanted a different challenge and was lured away by Chicago's rich legacy and unique big stage opportunity. You walk into the history, you walk into the energy, you walk into a place that you already know it demands your best. And that feeling is a feeling that I need to have, and I love to have, Council said in his introductory news conference back in 23 in Chicago. 17 years of relationships, that's hit you hard. The Brewers meant a lot to me. But after 2 years of self-reflection while still in Milwaukee, where Council had perhaps taken the Brewers as far as he could go, I thought a new challenge is where I had to push myself. Fans were still stunned and stinging when Council was asked if the Brewers had more resources, that is, deeper pockets, would he have stayed put in Brew City? More resources means different types of players, for sure. That's a different challenge for a manager, said Council. More resources, well, it's certainly something Chicago offers. It's part of the equation. To say it's payroll is probably simplifying it on my end. Numerous fans outright hated him for it, not appreciating or caring how bold and brave Council's move really was, one that left him, quote, a little scared. I'm sitting up here a little uncomfortable. You have to challenge yourself to go to the next place. That's part of this for me, to get better. It wasn't their job to understand. They've been faithful to the crew with a third longest pennant drought in Major League Baseball right now. And to be fair, this state of Wisconsin fan base has been through this nightmare scenario before and remembers that it was one win away from seeing Brett Favre take the hated Vikings to the Super Bowl. You can be damn sure they couldn't stomach the vision of Council taking the Cubs to the NLCS, and worse still, at the expense of Bob Uecker's Angels. But we have to be honest about why that really was a factor of reality for Council. And that's one thing, thankfully, Murphy will also not let us forget. Milwaukee is still the underdog in this league, and don't let 97 wins make you drunk with delirium to forget it. From mid-August to just one day ago, Murphy has been pounding the gavel for order in the court. Milwaukee is young, and Milwaukee is full of unheralded prospects. Criticize his team for blowing a 2-0 game lead in this series? Not when that environment in Chicago is that electric. Rip one of his pitchers, Quinn Priester, for a lackluster outing when he started the season in AAA and then blossomed into a big league starter? Murphy just can't stand for it, reminding us that while the Brewers have the greatest 2-year win total in franchise history, they've done that without the big roster, without the big budget, without the free agent signings, without the trade deadline stuff. So respect this team, Murphy said the day before Game 5. There's not one prognosticator that picked them over 500. So this team has overachieved all year. The lessons from the 66-year-old coach are welcome in this era of short attention spans, short tempers, and short-sighted takes. This is baseball. This is hard to do. We're the only small market team doing this, Murphy has said. That's why Murphy, in an MLB.com story, lovingly referred to his players as his average Joes, his woodpeckers, his cliffhangers. It's why, as far back as August, he wouldn't entertain the idea that his league-leading Brewers were favored against the Cubs. Seriously? They're the underdogs in this series, Murphy is quoted as saying in the MLB.com story. They've got all-stars. They've got MVP candidates. You've got veterans. You've got gold glove winners. You've got world champions. I mean, what don't they have? They're not the underdogs, trust me. It's important to remember all of it. This is why Council craved the change, to get out of this perpetual underdog mentality. And yet Murphy, the bench coach, the educator, the one who suffered a heart attack on the field in 2020, who walks every day in life with gratitude, was undaunted to take on the management role. It's also impossible not to notice how similar they both are. They both put the emphasis on their players. They both stand up for their teams. They both can admit to shortcomings. It really will take so much time to properly examine the layers of this Milwaukee victory over Chicago. Will there be books? A Netflix documentary? Please. Please. All of it. The teacher not yet beat by his pupil. The small market team winning enough games to secure home field advantage. The Brewers reminding fans not to sell their tickets. And the fans actually doing so, holding off big spending Cub fans to hold on to the important home field advantage. Then men in uniform, such as pitchers Aaron Civale and Colin Ray, who once played for the Brewers and were now facing their old team. The story has so many layers, from societal to draft and development to personal. Maybe there's only been a bigger upset story like this in history, and that one's in the Bible. But who has time for that now? The Los Angeles Dodgers? The defending world champions? The Shohei and company star power? Murphy again reminded us months ago who's who here. How many of our 13 position players make the Dodgers? He asked rhetorically. It's like, that's what's beautiful. They're our guys. They're our guys, that is. So we're always going to be the underdogs because of who these guys are. You can't measure it. It's time to move on and lean into the underdog role, but don't ever forget how big this night was. So now let's turn for a couple of articles on the American League teams. This one's by Gabe Lax, who's a columnist for USA Today. It's becoming increasingly chic for major league teams to roll out secret weapons in the postseason, to stick in a recent newcomer in the playoff rotation, or even let a kid make his major league debut with the season on the line. Most of the time, it's simply for show. And then Trey Savage took the ball for Game 2 of this American League Division Series, and the New York Yankees did not know what hit them. The Toronto Blue Jays right-hander, who completed a methodical climb through four levels of the minor leagues this season, struck out 11 Yankees through 5.5 hitless innings, including 6 in a row at one time, as the Blue Jays jumped out to a 12-0 lead and chased off Yankees ace Max Fried. With one out in the fifth inning and the results seemingly well in hand, Toronto manager John Schneider slowly walked to the mound to lift Yesavage after 78 pitches, salvaging his availability for later in the series. And the Rogers Center crowd rose for a thunderous ovation, demanding and receiving a curtain call from the kid. Just a couple of hours earlier, this might have looked like a mismatch. 19-game winner, World Series champion, and likely AL Cy Young Award winner, or at least a finalist, Fried against a kid who turned 22 in July and hasn't thrown a professional pitch until debuting in Class A Florida League this spring. But you Savage, it's appropriately pronounced something like you Savage, throttled a Yankees lineup with three former MVPs. His devastating splitter proved an impossible task for the Yankees as he induced 9 whiffs on 11 swings, plus 6 called strikes against the first 13 batters he faced. He finished the night with a 45% whiff and called strike percentage on his 48 strikes. But how? Well, turns out the time was just right for the Blue Jays to take the wraps off the kid. It probably wasn't an accident Yesavage's 3 major league outings in his September debut came against Tampa Bay, the Royals, and the Rays again, clubs that would be nowhere near the Blue Jays come in October. And to the casual observer, it might have come as a surprise that Yesavage would be penciled in for a Game 2 start while future Hall of Famer Max Scherzer, the 41-year-old veteran of 25 playoff starts, was left off the ALDS roster. Simply, unfamiliarity was Yesavage's huge ally, regardless of what shows up on an iPad or a pitch simulator. I think that can be a thing with a veteran team who can game plan really well, says Blue Jays manager John Schneider in an in-game interview with Fox Sports. Like anything, you need to watch and see if they make adjustments. It's tough to replicate on video or traject, whatever you want to call it, because it's a pretty unique look for sure, said Yankees manager Aaron Boone a half inning later. We're having a hard time getting a beat on that splitter he throws. The 6'4" Yesavage is tall, but hardly gargantuan by starting pitcher's standards. His great differentiator, though, is an arm angle that registers at 63 degrees, second highest behind only the New York Mets' Jonah Tong. What is it about these kids' arm angles? atop a mound 10 inches above home plate with an arm angle most hitters have never seen before, Yesavage can be impossible to hit, especially when you're not sure if what you're seeing is the devastating splitter or the 95-mile-an-hour fastball or his slider. Additionally, Yesavage has the ability to drop the splitter below the zone as hitters flail at it or pop it in for strikes, a conundrum for hitters. He was the 20th overall pick in the 24 draft out of East Carolina, and the Blue Jays gave him the rest of the year off, setting him up for his odyssey from Class A to the final two steps before the Blue Jays rolled the dice and brought him to Toronto. A Pennsylvania native, Yesavage earned some dude points by pitching in an NCAA regional for East Carolina just days after suffering a partially collapsed lung. All Yesavage did then was outduel soon-to-be number 2 overall pick Chase Burns of Wake Forest. With Yesavage providing the leverage the Blue Jays needed to tee off and take a double-digit lead and likely a 2-0 ALDS lead, it's likely we'll get to know this young man much more, even if hitters might flail at their first encounters. "I knew he'd do well," his mother Cheryl said in an in-game interview. "I never would have expected this." Yesavage and his family have already been subject to the darker side of sudden fame that increasingly haunts athletes in the spotlight. Yesavage had 4 strikeouts in 4 innings and gave up 5 earned runs in Game 2 of the AL Championship Series against the Mariners on the 13th. He began his news conference in advance of that outing, decrying the attacks and negativity on loved ones since his outing against the Yankees. "Living in this world where there's so many different opinions and feelings, which results in a lot of hate, it's sad to see that people close to me are being attacked for my performances on the field," Yesavage told reporters in Toronto before ALCS Game 1. "These people have done things to warrant negativity for my actions. They've actually done nothing to warrant negativity, whether that's my parents, my brothers, my girlfriend, family, and it's just really sad. I know I have the platform to address it, so I am. I hope that people can realize that those individuals have nothing to do with what happens on the field or whatnot. If you have a problem, I'm a man. I can take whatever opinions anybody has about me or my life. So I just wanted to get that out there." Yesavage did not elaborate on the source of the hateful comments or the platforms in which they were received. It's unlikely they came from Toronto fans, as Yesavage was a national hero in Canada after the Yankees game. It wasn't a lot of hate there, it's just kind of saying this is new for him, obviously. But I think him kind of protecting people that are close to him, I commend him for saying that, Schneider told reporters after Yesavage's comments. "It's unfortunate that that's a reality. I commend him for saying what he said and for backing up the people that love and support him." Now for you Yankee fans and non-fans, here's a column by Gabe Blacks, who's a writer for USA Today. "The New York Yankees are going home for the winter without a World Series title for the 16th consecutive year, and the only thing outrageous about it is how it's honestly no outrage. Be honest, Yankee fans. Are you mad? Angry at Aaron Boone for falling short once again? Well, the man lost his ace in March, managed the team to a tie for a division title, and kept them alive in an American League division series in which other starters couldn't get past the third inning. Irate that Aaron Judge still isn't the truest Yankee because he doesn't yet have a World Series ring? Well, the man simply hit one of the greatest home runs in recent playoff history to save their season, had 13 hits and 26 postseason at-bats, and produced one of the finest offensive seasons ever. Incensed that general manager for life, Brian Cashman, simply isn't doing enough, or that owner Hal Steinbrenner isn't willing to do what it takes to get the Yankees over the top? Well, the latter laid out $750 million for Juan Soto, only to see him skip across town, and the former pivoted brilliantly to reallocate resources and put a championship-caliber club on the field. Sure, this isn't the old days where no expense was spared, sustainability was a word reserved for losers, and the boss demanded a level of success that rarely was met. No, this is 2025, and while the pinstripes can evoke nostalgia, and newest Yankee Stadium's roars can still intimidate an opponent, a different reality has settled in. The Yankees are simply one of a half dozen or so teams committed to winning every year, yet no more powerful to bend the capricious postseason odds in their favor. It's somewhat appropriate that the Yankees are going home after losing this division series 3-1 to the Blue Jays, while the Seattle Mariners are still alive. The Mariners GM, Jerry DePoto, caused a great deal of concern and disgust within the game when, after the club fell shy of a playoff berth in 2023, he said, "Any franchise's aim should be to win, 54% of the time." The implication? Win 87.5 games every single year, and you'll make the playoffs more often than not. And perhaps one of those autumns, every ball will bounce the right way, every deep fly ball won't die at the track, and you'll win the last game of the season. DePoto was ripped mercilessly, an avatar of the game's modern urge to drain all the passion out of the sport and create a frictionless, sterile pastime. He apologized profusely, but it's kind of funny to look back a few years later. The Mariners have won between 85 and 90 games every year since 2021, and this year have a fairly legitimate World Series shot. The Yankees would never admit to such cold calculations, but the same concept applies, just in a slightly higher tax bracket. Call them the 58 percenters. They won 94 games in 24, 94 games in 25, a 580 winning percentage that earned them one division title, a tie for another, and a World Series appearance. That the Blue Jays claimed the division title on a tiebreaker forced the Yankees for the first time into the wildcard series. In the most generous interpretation, that means they had a 1-in-12 shot at winning it all. Is this a failure worth kvetching over? It is unfortunate for them that they haven't been able to construct a true Death Star like the Los Angeles Dodgers, whose unparalleled draft and develop apparatus and deep pockets have produced 13 straight playoff berths, 2 World Series titles, and 4 NL pennants. Not only has that machine kept the Dodgers in October constant, the Yankees have missed the playoffs 4 times since their World Series title in 2009. It also makes them incredibly attractive to outsiders. They're favorites to repeat as World Series champions because of Shohei Ohtani and Yoshinobu Yamamoto and perhaps even Roki Sasaki, a trio whose Dodger destinations seemed a fait accompli. A generation ago, that would have been the Yankees' domain. But Hal Steinbrenner and fam never seemed inclined to throw money around in a relative sense like the boss did, or even like their restless Steve Cohen across town. So they'll have to make do with 320-ish million dollar rosters, a perpetual hole or two that might get punched each winter, and the hope that there's enough dry powder in the farm system to re-up at the trade deadline. The process begins anew. Cody Bellinger is probably a goner, perhaps finally earning the 9-figure payday he long seemed due. Same with Paul Goldschmidt and Devin Williams, worthy contributors in their single year in pinstripes. There are growing rumblings of a so-called judge window that the big fellow turns 34 in April and 6'7" bodies are a little more challenging to maintain relative to the average dude. That's kind of silly. Judge has many good years ahead of him and has been a virtual constant October presence. This is no Mike Trout situation, a generational great stuck in baseball purgatory more than a decade, until his body no longer does the things that made the masses thirst for a championship on his behalf. Judge should get his ring at some point, perhaps next year. Gerrit Cole should be back sometime in the first half, and Lewis Heel healthy from the jump. While retaining or replacing Bellinger, Kyle Tucker remains the biggest lift on the lineup side. The greatest concern may be cleaning up the fundamentals on a club prone to lapses, such as Jazz Chisholm's costly error in their Game 4 elimination, although shortstop Anthony Volpe made great strides on both sides of the ball to that end late in the season. And if Judge never wins it at all, well, there have been worse indignities in this game. Judge will probably pass 400 home runs in 2026, while Giancarlo Stanton closes in on 500. The Yankees remain a highly entertaining team and a business built on, well, entertainment. But it's also a competitive business with the most demanding fans in the industry. Just keep in mind, the Dodgers needed 11 consecutive playoff runs to win their first full season title in this run. The Yankees are going on 8 fruitless playoff runs in 9 years. They should be impervious to such modern trappings as playoff odds or win curves. But come October, they're no different than the Phillies or the Dodgers or the Mets or now the Blue Jays. Sure, it's disappointing for a Yankee fan. It's just not worth getting mad about. Now here's a story about another championship that's just concluded. This is by Nancy Armour, a columnist with USA Today. The Houston Comets, the Minnesota Lynx, and now the Las Vegas Aces. With their third title in 4 years, the Aces have firmly cemented themselves as one of the WNBA's dynasties. By completing a sweep of the Phoenix Mercury on Friday night in the league's first best-of-seven WNBA finals, at a time when the level of play in the women's league has never been higher, the Aces might just be the best team ever. They have the best player on the planet in Aja Wilson, the best facilitator in Chelsea Gray, the best two-way guard in Jackie Young, and the best coach in Becky Hammon. Add in a bench that includes former scoring champion Jewel Lloyd and sharpshooter Dana Evans, and they could shatter the WNBA's record for titles won by a single franchise before their reign is over. I just think the evolving of the game, I left the game in 14, these players are bigger, stronger, faster, and more skilled than just 10 years ago, said Hammond, who faced both the Comets and Lynx during her playing career. Those dynasties laid the groundwork, showed how winning could be done, and really gave a lot to the W insofar as history. It's really great to talk about it, but the skill set and the level that these guys are at, to me, it's not comparable. These ladies are at the top of the game, and it's the best basketball the W has ever seen, from top to bottom. At this rate, the biggest threat might be the next collective bargaining agreement, because the current deal expires October 31st. The Aces are an incredibly tight-knit group. The post-game news conference with Hammond, Wilson, Gray, Young, and Lloyd was a hilarious love fest, and it's hard to imagine them losing their core. But salaries are expected to soar, and every franchise will be throwing money at them. Heck, everyone else on the Las Vegas roster, too. Not if owner Mark Davis has anything to do with it. When he bought the Aces in 2021, Davis did so partly because he thought the players were being shortchanged financially and he wanted to change that. Now that the players are about to cash in, he will be happy to pay the tab if it means keeping the dynasty going. "I'm going to keep everybody," he told USA Today. "We have to see how this all shakes out, but yeah, obviously we want to continue what we're doing. It would be tough to break it up. It would be a shame, too. It's hard enough to win one title, let alone to earn yourself the title of dynasty. If you're lucky enough to find yourself in that position, you do everything in your power to protect it and keep it going for as long as you can." "I'm grateful to be with this bunch," Wilson said, "and that ain't the alcohol talking. That's what makes this title particularly sweet, because it wasn't that long ago the Aces didn't look like playoff contenders, let alone dynasty material." In an 8-day span after the All-Star break, Las Vegas was walloped twice by the Minnesota Lynx. Not just beaten, ground into proverbial dust, losing by 31 points the first game and 53 the second. And the great teams figure things out. The Aces closed the regular season on a 16-game winning streak. They would win 25 of their last 28 games, including all 4 against the Mercury. The 97-86 win over Phoenix on Friday was their second by double digits in the finals and 5th of the playoffs. They joined the Comets as the only WNBA teams to win 3 titles in 4 years. The Comets won 4 in a row from 97 to 2000. To be here right now, after where we were in May and June, there were a lot of doubts besides in our locker room, Gray said. We had confidence in each other. I'm just really proud of how we stayed the course and trusted the process the entire time. While the sweep might suggest otherwise, the Aces had to show that resolve in the finals. They led by 20 points early in the third quarter on October 10th, only to have Phoenix storm back and make a game of it, just as they did in Game 3. Despite not having Satu Sabali and Mercury coach Nate Tibbetts getting tossed after their back-to-back technicals, they got within 6 points twice in the fourth quarter. But the Aces are simply too good. Their run will end on their terms, not someone else's. "We ran into a really good team," Tibbetts said. "We ran into a team that's been through it together. We ran into a team that had the ultimate belief and trust that they could get it done." Gray and Young combined for 11 points during a two-minute span to put Vegas back up by double digits at 89-78, with only 4:26 left. All that was left to do was uncork the champagne and start planning the parade. "This one hits different because it was different," Hammond said, choking back tears. "There was probably a lot more adversity than any of us anticipated. We're all humans, but humans that wanted to get it right and get it right together." Get it right they did, and now they're a team for the ages, pushing the bar by which all future WNBA teams will be measured to the highest of heights. Now let's turn to pro football and read the 32 Things We Learned by Nate Davis. 0. Still the number of wins the New York Jets have since January 5th, former quarterback Aaron Rodgers' final game with the organization. Rookie coach Aaron Glenn, now 0-6, was already the first head man in team history to start his career 0-5. 1. The number of undrafted players to amass at least 200 yards from scrimmage in consecutive games since the 1970 AFL-NFL merger. That would be Carolina Panthers running back Rico Dowdle, who followed up his 234-yard performance with 239 more plus a TD, while making good on his bid for revenge against his former team, the Cowboys. He's the only player of any kind in the past 5 seasons with back-to-back 200-yard days. Dowdle, who rushed for nearly 1,100 yards with Dallas in 24 but was not re-signed, has started the past 2 games for injured Chuba Howard, both of them narrow Carolina wins. 1A. Dowdle's big day also marked the most yards from scrimmage a player had posted against his former team. 2. The top two players picked atop the 24 draft, Chicago Bears quarterback Caleb Williams and Washington Commanders quarterback Jaden Daniels, met for the second time in 2 seasons on Monday Night Football. Last year's matchup ended with Daniels tossing a game-winning Hail Mary, which helped spark the Commanders' push to the NFC title game while sending Chicago into a 10-game tailspin. What this writer didn't know at the time this went to press was that Chicago turned the tables just the other night and beat Washington at the last minute with a field goal. 3. Yet New England's Patriot quarterback Drake May, the third player off the draft board in 2024, is compiling quite a case that he might eventually be the best of the bunch. May tied his career high with 3 TD passes and a 25-19 defeat of the New Orleans Saints. His 140.1 passer rating was the second best of his tenure. 4. And while it's rather granular accomplishment, thank you Analytics and Major League Baseball for the rise of arcane factoids, May joined Patrick Mahomes, Dak Prescott, and Dan Mariano as the only passers with at least 200 passing yards and a passer rating of at least 100.0 in 5 consecutive games prior to their 24th birthday. Wow, that is an obscure factoid. 5. The number of wins the Indianapolis Colts have in their first 6 games, something they last accomplished in Hall of Fame quarterback Peyton Manning's heyday back in 2009, a season that concluded in the Super Bowl. Super Bowl number 44, that is. 5A. If the season ended now, the Colts and Tampa Bay Buccaneers would be your number one playoff seeds. 6. Indianapolis rookie Tyler Warren continues to be a huge component of the Colts' success, pacing the team with 6 catches, 63 yards, and a TD in the tight win over the decimated Arizona Cardinals. The most notable thing about Warren is that he's been able to carry over, let's call it his positionless tight end usage, from Penn State. Remember, this is number 7, remember when tank for Tua was a thing prior to the 2020 draft? Well, I don't. Quarterback Tua Tagovailoa was picked off 3 times for the Miami Dolphins, who got him with the 5th pick 5 years ago before calling out his teammates after a 29-27 loss to the Chargers. Tagovailoa was completely upstaged in South Florida by the players who were chosen one spot after him, Bolts quarterback Justin Herbert, who passed for 264 yards and 2 TDs as his team broke a 2-game slide. His 42-yard completion to wide receiver Ladd McConkey in the final minute set up LA's winning field goal. 9. The Seattle Seahawks beat the Jaguars 20-12 in Jacksonville for their club record 9th consecutive road victory, currently the longest in the NFL. Second-year coach Mike McDonald is 10-1 away from Seattle's raucous Lumen Field, which has witnessed just 4 wins since the start of the 24 season. 9A. The number of times, spread over 8 defenders, that the Broncos sacked Jets quarterback Justin Fields, pushing Denver's league-leading total to 30. Fields was bagged by Jonathan Cooper and Justin Strand on New York's final offensive play of 4th and 8 from the Denver 44-yard line, which apparently was not within kicker Nick Folk's range. Negative 10. The Jets' net passing yards in the loss after Fields threw for 45. The Broncos' 9 sacks led to 55 yards in aggregate losses. The figure marked the fewest passing yards in New York Jets history and league-wide this century, while also being the fewest Denver has ever allowed. 11. The number of consecutive games in which the Cleveland Browns have failed to score more than 17 points. They're 1-10 in that stretch, following a 23-9 loss to the Pittsburgh Steelers. 12. Browns rookie quarterback Dillon Gabriel threw the ball 52 times, which produced 221 yards or 4.3 per attempt. That doesn't even account for the 38 yards lost on the 6 sacks he suffered. 13. Still, coach Kevin Stefanski opted not to give the newly promoted rookie backup quarterback Shedeur Sanders the opportunity to make his NFL regular season debut. 14. Elsewhere in the AFC North, former Browns quarterback Joe Flacco, now starting for the Cincinnati Bengals following last week's trade, needed 45 throws to pass for 219 yards and 2 TDs in his Cincy debut. 15. Unfortunately, the Burrow-less, Flacco-full Bengals could only change so many stripes, still unable to run the ball, 55 yards, or stop a nosebleed in the 27-18 loss to the Green Bay Packers, who tacked up 409 yards. 16. Speaking of misfortune, at some point you have to feel for the snake-bitten San Francisco 49ers, who lost all-pro linebacker Fred Warner to a dislocated and fractured ankle that will require surgery and undoubtedly end his season. 17. The number of points scored by the Chargers kicker Cameron Dicker, who drilled all 5 of his field goal attempts and both PATs. He is currently, by far, the most accurate kicker in NFL history, his field goal success rate at 94.6%. He's perfect on all 14 of his field goal tries in 2025. 18. How bad has it gotten for the Baltimore Ravens? They managed to hold the Los Angeles Rams to 17 points and wide receiver Puka Nacua to 2 catches before he was injured, and they still lost by 14. 19. Might help to hand the ball to running back Derrick Henry near the goal line and leave the tush pushing to the Eagles. 20. But don't worry all that much, Raven fans. Injured quarterback Lamar Jackson should be ready to ride to the rescue with reinforcements following the team's Week 7 and Week 6 bye. Elsewhere, this is number 21, in the AFC North, Pittsburgh now has as many wins, that's four, as the rest of the division combined. Woof. 22. The number of consecutive times the Steelers have beaten the Browns in Pittsburgh in the regular season, a streak that dates to 2003. Led then quarterback Baker Mayfield, the Browns did win a playoff game at the Acrisure Stadium during the 2020 postseason. 23. The Steelers are turning defensive back Jalen Ramsey into quite the multifaceted weapon. The seven-time Pro Bowler, acquired over the summer from the Dolphins, has been deployed all over Pittsburgh's defense and recorded the first multi-sack game of his 10-year career. 24. Despite losing Warner and dealing with myriad other injuries, including quarterback Brock Purdy's missing the game, the Niners are getting plenty from Christian McCaffrey, who became the first running back with at least 100 yards from scrimmage in each of his team's first six games since Saquon Barkley did it for the New York Giants in 18. 25. CMC, that's McCaffrey, is also the first back to post at least 50 receiving yards in each of his team's first six games to start a season. With 46 catches already, he's also tied for the most by a running back through six games of a season with Matt Forte in 2014 and Alvin Kamara back in 2020. Number 26, what kind of company is Max Crosby keeping? He had two sacks in the Las Vegas Raiders' defeat of the Tennessee Titans. But here's the greater context. Crosby now has 10 tackles for loss in 25, joining Jared Allen and Aaron Donald as the only players in the 21st century with at least 10 tackles for loss in each of their first seven seasons. 27. The latest feather in Mahomes' immortal hat? In his 138th game, that is, 138th game, including the postseason, he threw his 300th TD pass and reached that benchmark 9 games earlier than Rodgers, previously the fastest player to that plateau. 28. The number of 1 p.m. kickoffs the Seahawks have had on the East Coast over the past decade. They're 22-6 in those games. 29. It was the hometown Jags who appeared to be jet-lagged 6 days after their Monday Night Football win, October 6, over the Chiefs. They entered Week 6 with a league-best 14 takeaways, but failed to record one in a game for the first time this season. They also committed 10 penalties and surrendered 7 sacks of quarterback Trevor Lawrence. 30. And while you could continue to question the impact of Jaguars rookie wide receiver slash cornerback Travis Hunter, his double duty did place him in the same company as Hall of Famer Deion Sanders, who was also Hunter's head coach at the University of Colorado. Per Optostats, Hunter became the first NFL player to catch at least 4 passes and record multiple tackles on defense in the same game since Sanders did it 29 years ago. 31. But let's scrap this relative, that is, negativity, for the 4-2 Jags, who also provided the best moment when defensive end Josh Hines Allen's son, a cancer survivor, participated in the pregame coin toss. The NFL always gets its share of backlash, but the league is a force for good with its crucial catch campaign. And last but not least, 32. Your MVP through 6 weeks? Gotta be Mayfield, who continues losing wideouts to injury, including rookie Emeka Egbuka with a hamstring last Sunday, but keeps firing TD passes to whomever is downfield, Cameron Johnson and Tez Johnson in the defeat of San Francisco, for NFC leading Tampa Bay. Okay, let's go to another pro football story. This one about New York Giants running back Cam Scatabo. This is by Art Stapleton, writing for the USA Today Network. Cam Scatabo has brought a legacy to the New York Giants that he has established by inflicting punishment on the football field. Before Scatabo earned the Angry Runs scepter from NFL Network's Kyle Brandt for his preferred physicality in a pair of plays from his NFL debut, you should go back and revisit the most memorable run of his career to this point, one he chases every time he puts on a helmet and steps between the lines. The relentlessness with which Scatterball plays was never more evident than one of his three touchdowns he had for Rio Linda High in the 2018 5AA State Championship out in California. He rushed for 396 yards in a 38-35 victory, and one of those scoring jaunts stole the show. Scatago broke a staggering 10 tackles on a 67-yard scamper in which it appeared every member of the San Giorgino defense had a chance at dragging him down. You know what? I didn't even count how many tackles he broke, Jack Garceau, Scatabo's coach at Rio Linda, recalled with a laugh during an interview with NorthJersey.com and The Record. It was fun to watch, and it was one of those things, as you watched it, it was like, what's going on? Felt like the play took a minute and a half to develop front to back. That was a single-guy effort. That's who he is. If you could encapsulate his football career and his ability into one play, that would be it. So how does the 5'10", 215-pound Scatterball go from teenager who was told he was too small and too slow to play for Southern Cal, UCLA, and others, when the coaches came through Garceau's office on recruiting business visits to the big stage with the Giants, bare chest, bumping former NFL quarterback Ryan Fitzpatrick in celebration on the Amazon Prime Video post-game set last Thursday? Boy, that was a long one. Scatterball was dominating presence with three TDs and 98 yards rushing for the Giants in an eye-opening upset of the reigning Super Bowl champion Philadelphia Eagles. He's crazy. Football crazy, there's no doubt about that. It's who he is, Giants co-captain receiver Darius Slayton said of Scatterball. But he's the right kind of crazy. And Scatterball and quarterback Jackson Dart have shoved their way into the spotlight with a bit of gridiron naivete for how bad things have been around with the Giants for the last decade plus. Straight out of a late 70s skit from Saturday Night Live, Dart and Scatterball are relishing the opportunity to become Big Blue's culture-changing, wild, and crazy guys. With an infusion of swagger, toughness, aura, and talent, the two rookies who now spend their days in stalls next to each other in the locker room seemed plenty comfortable being the symbols of a franchise's stunning breakthrough as a national audience watched and fell over itself in admiration. We have to continue to build on this, but we're still 2-4, Scatterball said. We have to go out there and win the next one, and win the next one, and win the next one. I'm excited for the future, and I can't wait. Scatterball has had his share of nicknames through the year. He was Houdini to his family for an ability to somehow escape car seats when he was in diapers with relative ease. Scatterball used to watch WWE with his late grandfather, so in high school, teammates began referring to him as Nature Boy, an homage to the 16-time world wrestling champion Ric Flair. He embraced that so much, Scatterball would scream out Flair's trademark, "Woo!" whenever he trucked a defender. He did that on more than one occasion this summer with the Giants, with the team's social media account putting out a "Woo!" compilation as a hype video. They've come to expect the personality, and now Scatterball is delivering the production, taking the lead in the backfield as Tyrone Tracy missed two games with a dislocated shoulder. Gosh, more than anything, he reminds me of a Plinko chip from The Price is Right, NFL Network analyst Daniel Jeremiah said of Scatterball, who's rushed 82 times for 338 yards and five touchdowns, and he has 20 catches for an additional 155 yards, bouncing off everything and everybody. Scatterball was told NFL scouts predicted this perceived flaw in his game would hold him back. Everybody said I couldn't pass protect. That was the big question mark next to my name, he told NorthJersey.com and The Record at his locker recently. Scouts said it. I heard it. My coach at Ohio State, rather Arizona State, forgive me, Coach Denny Dillingham, sat me down and said, this is what they're saying. Pass protection, pass protection, pass protection. First, Scatterball got mad at those trying to poke holes in his game, so he started watching cut-ups of the plays in question. Then he went to work in a quest to turn the most talked-about weakness in his game to a strength. And that mission has revealed itself over the first 6 weeks of the season with Scatterball's emergence. It's important to send a message every chance I get, but it's really most important because it's part of my job, said Scatterball, who is only 23. This is my job from here on out, and hopefully I never have to work again after I'm done playing this game. If that's what it's going to take for me to continue to play this game for as long as I want, if that's what it's going to take, I've got to get better at it. Scatabo's reputation as a football bruiser preceded him to the NFL. That's a lot to live up to as a rookie, but he's game. His first two plays as a professional, out of 8 total snaps, did just that in the Giants' season-opening 21-6 loss to Washington, starting with a crushing blitz pickup on which he stonewalled defensive back Tyler Owens, allowing a 25-yard completion, the longest play they had in Week 1. Then, on his first touch, Scatterball caught a swing pass and trucked rookie cornerback Trey Amos and shoved linebacker Frankie Louvu out of the way before muscling through safety Will Harris, who managed to finally take him down. The play only went for 6 yards, but drew oohs and ahs around the league. In my recruitment during the pre-draft process, I told the coaches, "I'm going to be ready to pass pro when I get there," Scatabo said. It wasn't that I was bad at it, but I'd touched the ball 3 or 4 times in a drive, and when it was time for me to pass pro, I was exhausted. There were times when I looked really bad doing it, and I understand. Scatabo missed significant time in training camp recovering from a hamstring injury that kept him off the field. The Giants' 4th-round pick is proving now that he can be more than a novelty that gets the fans and media riled up with his style of play. Still, Scatabo admits to learning at the level about the intricacies of the position, how the backs fit into the blocking schemes, and not just where to run within the offense. His vision is exceptional. And that comes with a better understanding and feel for the big picture one game to the next, rather one play to the next. There's times I looked good at it, and there's times when I looked really bad in pass pro, Scatabo said. And you have to question the bad part, wonder why it's like that. If they give me the ball 4 times here in a drive, and then I'm ready to pass pro, am I going to do the same thing in college? I know those questions raise up and make people wonder, but I'm a football player. I play my hardest every play. In college, Scatabo simply broke tackles or ran through defenders, with some scouts pushing the opinion that he plays more like a linebacker than a running back. He does not shy away from contact, and that was a varsity icon in his hometown even before. As a junior, he rushed for 3,550 yards and 42 touchdowns in a single season. Scatabo forced 103 missed tackles last season, and 1,202 of his 1,712 rushing yards came after contact. He had 45 runs of 10 yards or more, and 21 runs of 15 or more yards, with 21 touchdowns rushing and 3 touchdowns receiving. With respect to Bruce Banner's Hulk, Scatabo is eager to show there is more to his game as a complete running back than the one you love to see when he's angry. Me and Scat just have a lot of talks. We sat next to each other on the plane back from New Orleans, and it definitely hurt us a lot because we felt we absolutely should have won that game, Dart said. We just keep telling each other we got each other. We're going to lay it all on the line each and every play for each other. We try to message that to our teammates as much as possible. We know everybody is going to rally around each other the more we have performances like this. We can't get too high, but we can't get too low either. The most important thing is the next moment. Scatabo has shown he is comfortable pairing with Dart and taking on what has been a near impossible challenge of changing the perception of the Giants. And yes, if that comes with a little bit of crazy too, so be it. And that's going to do it for today, dear listeners. Once again, this is Kent Batty, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thank you for listening.